the court. Eugene Turing on behalf of plaintiff appellant Sandra Curran, also known as Sandra Rechny. Your Honor, this case comes before this court on our appeal from summary judgment which trial court granted for defendant. The basis for summary judgment was that the trial court found that our client stood in her attorney's shoes for the purposes of receiving EEOC right to sue notice. It's very important to note that the general rule is gotta be an actual receipt of the right to sue letter by either claimant or claimant's attorneys. Our client retained the law firm of Steckler & Steckler immediately after she filed her EEOC charge. Unfortunately, at the time when the EEOC sent its right to sue notice to Steckler & Steckler, that firm was not in existence. This fact is not in dispute. The principal of the firm declared bankruptcy, Barbara Steckler surrendered her law license, and the firm was not in the business.
What happened to Mr. Greenberg?
I don't know, Your Honor, what happened to
Samuel
Mr.
Greenberg.
I know that the letter was sent to Steckler & Steckler, and it was addressed on top to Mr. Greenberg, who was, I assume, an associate with Steckler & Steckler. But the letter came back because simply at that address there was no law firm of Steckler & Steckler.
And it looks like the person who abandoned his client is Mr. Greenberg. And I checked. He's still an attorney in good standing with the ARDC.
I believe, Your Honor, that the attorney
client... Maybe he shouldn't be in good standing having abandoned his client.
I believe that the record shows that there is a retainer agreement between Steckler & Steckler and our client, and Mr. Greenberg was not party to that retainer agreement. He was an associate with the law firm. Since the law firm disappeared, he was no longer there, and the letter came back undelivered. So there was no actual receipt of the right to sue notice in this case. However, the trial courts held that Steckler & Steckler did stand in the shoes of our client for the purposes of the notice. One major error that we think the trial court made, and for which we urge this court to reverse the summary judgment, is that for the purposes of the notice, as it was held in Jones versus Medicine Service, there has to be an attorney-client relationship which was existing at the time when the notice was either delivered or when the EEOC sent the notice. And this is not in dispute in this case, that there was no attorney-client relationship at that time. The law firm simply disappeared, and attorneys went their own ways. Therefore, there was nobody there to stood in Sandra's shoes. Steckler & Steckler didn't stand in anyone's shoes, including its own. That law firm disappeared, and the principal filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
She didn't actually. I mean, you have a balancing here. A defendant obviously has an interest in the enforcement of the statute of limitations, so... What diligence did she demonstrate? She moved, so she didn't get the notice, and she sits around for a year before she wakes up and...
I understand the question. Here's our response to that. Defendant invited the trial court to expand on the exception which was created in St. Louis versus Alverno College case. The exception to the actual receipt rule is very narrow. EEOC sends out the notice. The claimant doesn't get the notice because it's at a different address. Therefore, clock starts to tick. That's a very simple rule, very easy to determine. When EEOC sends the notice, then the statute of limitations starts to run. In this case, EEOC did not send the notice to Sandra in 1998 in violation of its own regulations. So if the defendant's logic and reasoning is accepted, and if the trial court decision is affirmed, then there would be, in any case, when the EEOC doesn't send the notice and the defendant jumps in and says, oh, by the way, the claimant was not diligent in doing this, this, and this, and even if the EEOC sent the notice, that wouldn't matter. Would first of all lead to waste of resources, and second of all, it would be never possible to determine what was the day one from which the 90-day rule runs, because the notice is not sent. As simple as that. So we urge this court to vacate the summary judgment and remand the case for further proceedings, because the exception which and the defendant's argument is contrary to Jones versus Medicine Service, and at least the trial court should have held an evidentiary hearing as to whether there was an actual attorney-client relationship between our client and Steckler & Steckler at the time when the notice was sent. No such hearing was held, and there is no evidence on the record to support or even hint at that there was such attorney-client relationship existing in April of 1998 when EOC sent its notice to Steckler & Steckler. Our last argument is that in this case, this is unfortunate chain of events. People do place their trust in the legal profession. However rare that happens, lawyers do go out of business. So in this case, defendants should
what
not get...
What is the relationship between between Arnold Landis, who is listed on the brief along with you, and Steckler & Steckler?
The trial court never addressed this issue and never ruled on that. This issue was briefed in the appellate brief, and we responded in our reply that the relationship between Arnold Landis, Steckler & Steckler, and Sandra Curran was as follows. Arnold Landis was a co-counsel which agreed to represent her in litigation in the case if the EOC issues the right to sue notice. He never wrote to EOC. He never put his address on the EOC files, and he didn't have to, because he did not agree and she did not agree that he would represent her in the EOC proceedings. They agreed
he
that...
He wasn't affiliated with the Steckler
firm? No, he wasn't, Jude. He was not. And this is also not in dispute. So in this case, because of this unfortunate chain of events, defendant asked the trial court, and actually they got a windfall. And if the trial court is affirmed, then that would lead to unwarranted expansion of the very narrow exception to the very important actual receipt rule. Actual receipt rule is very important for one major reason. This is not a plain vanilla statute of limitations case. And in these types of cases, the statute of limitations starts to run when the EOC issues the decision. This is a third party, which is not related to the plaintiff or defendant. So both plaintiff and defendant, they sit and wait when the EOC makes a decision. And that's when the clock starts ticking. So therefore, the actual knowledge is of extreme importance here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Turin. Mr. Pardis?
Good morning, Your Honors. I may please the court, counsel. If we take the argument of the plaintiffs to its logical conclusion, what they would suggest is that a neglectful attorney and a neglectful client can essentially toll the statute of limitations for an unlimited time period, and then the defendant loses the entire benefit of finality in a time frame that the statute of limitations intended to provide. Here we have the law firm of Steckler & Steckler sending a letter to the EOC saying that they are representing Ms. Curran Oreshny along with attorney Arnold Landis. Both attorneys are listed on that letter. The retainer agreement between Ms. Oreshny and the Steckler firm also indicates that Landis and Steckler are being retained. We did raise this issue below in our reply brief. We indicate that the plaintiff has no excuse for her neglect over a period of 500-plus days, in that why didn't she, when she couldn't reach the Steckler firm, why didn't she attempt to contact her other lawyer, attorney Arnold Landis? That's at page 7 and 8 of our reply brief before the district court. In this case, the plaintiff has provided the EEOC with an initial address. Despite both the case law and the rules that require that she provide them with an updated address, she fails to do that. The fact that the Steckler firm has allegedly disbanded doesn't mean that they've lost their obligation to their client. They still have an obligation to their client, whatever that might be, whether it be notifying the EOC that it was withdrawing from representation, notifying her.
What happened to the other Steckler? One Steckler was disbarred. what happened to Stackler number two?
I do not know that, Your Honor.
How many other partners were there in that firm?
From the letterhead, Your Honor, it looked like there were just two partners, the two Stacklers. Mr. Greenberg, I think his name was, allegedly was an associate. I just don't know the information. But that law firm, regardless of what happened to it, as Your Honor had stated, the attorney who wrote the letter certainly had an obligation. That firm had an obligation. The fact that they disbanded doesn't do away with their obligation to the client. The lawyer does stand in the shoes of the plaintiff for purposes of receiving notice in this case. They did not advise the EEOC that there had been a disbandment of the firm, that they were withdrawing from representation, and the letter was sent to the place it needed to be sent. Had it been sent to Ms. Reshny, as the rules would require a copy of, it would have made no difference because she had moved from that address, and according to her deposition, there's no evidence in the record that she provided even the post office with a notice of a change of address, much less the EEOC. This court has held on multiple occasions in the past that the actual receipt rule is not applicable in those cases where the reason for and tolling will not apply in those cases where the plaintiff herself has been neglectful in her own case. Here, Ms. Reshny files her complaint in 95. We're 3 years down the road after the hearing is done, the investigatory hearing is done. She makes absolutely no effort to contact the EEOC. Unlike the client in the Davis case, which they have relied upon, in Davis there's a period of a couple of months between the right to sue letter being issued and Mr. Davis contacting the EEOC to saying, where's my right to sue letter? Here, Ms. Reshny offers no excuse whatsoever for her failure to contact them, offers no excuse whatsoever for failing to contact Attorney Landis, her other attorney. And under these facts, it is, again, as I stated at the beginning, if we allow this to occur, a neglectful lawyer and a neglectful client.
And I take it that Landis has never said that he checked with the EEOC periodically.
There is nothing in the record below.
No claim that he tried to find out the status and the EEOC wouldn't tell him or anything like that.
There is nothing in the record to suggest that it happened at all, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record in the affidavit submitted by Mr. Landis to suggest that he made any attempt to contact the EEOC to find out the status of this case, as could have been done, as a simple phone call says, here's where it is. Either it's been issued or it's not been issued.
Well, simple phone calls to federal agencies are a formula for things going wrong.
But the bottom line here, Your Honor, is that...
Does the EEOC have an automated docket, by the way?
I do not know that, Your Honor. I know I would call on occasion to contact them to find out the status, and I'd get an individual to speak to. I don't know whether or not there was a... But this was several years ago already. I don't know if their docket's automated or not. The concern that we have here is that the statute of limitations are intended to give parties finality. A defendant should be able to close his file and say, I don't have to worry about this case anymore. That had happened. The right to sue letter had been issued. 591 days later, the lawsuit's filed. It's a 90-day time period. Furthermore, one other point that's significant is that under the rules, within 180 days of the charge being filed, the EEOC has to do one of two. It has to either enter into conciliation agreement with the parties, make a determination dismissing the case, or alternatively give the parties, the charging party, notice of its right to sue. The attorneys could have made a demand saying it's 180 days. We would like you to issue that letter. There's no evidence in the underlying records to suggest that that was ever done as well. Across the board, this is neglectful conduct by the attorneys, by the petitioner herself, and the plaintiff herself, I'm sorry, and this is what the statute of limitations was designed to prohibit. And in this case, if the court does not affirm that decision, it is endorsing a concept where a neglectful client and a neglectful attorney can continue to toll the statute of limitations until they're ready to do something about it. And that's clearly not what the intention of these rules should be. So with that in mind, we would ask that the ruling of Judge Zagel be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pardis. Mr. Turin, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Just a quick in response to the
But is
opponents.
It correct that Landis received the notice?
No, there was second notice issued, Your Honor. EEOC issued another notice in 99. They admitted that they didn't send it to her. They issued another one, and that's where the whole lawsuit was filed timely.
No, but I mean they sent a notice to the lawyer, to Stackler.
Yeah, they did. That's the only notice in issue.
Not to Landis?
No.
He didn't get a notice.
He never inquired because he didn't have any obligation to do so because
My question was just whether
they did not send notice to Landis.
No.
Okay. There is no evidence to that. So Defendant Appellee keeps arguing that this is a lawyer's negligence and she should take responsibility for that. The issue is they were not her lawyers at that time. This is a crucial issue. They were not her lawyers at that time. That's the answer to the contention.
Because they abandoned the case or what?
They severed attorney-client relationship.
They
client severed? Can fire a lawyer or a lawyer can terminate the relationship with the client.
How did they terminate it? I don't understand.
They dissolved the law firm.
That does not terminate a lawyer's obligation to a client.
If the lawyer...
You dissolve your law firm, or if Sidley and Austin dissolves, the lawyer's obligations to their client are completely unaffected. They do not free themselves of their obligations by changing their partnership structure. That's a pretty fundamental principle.
I would like to respond to the second part of my opponent's argument, which invites the court, they invited the trial court to do so, and now they invite this court to do so as well, to search for blame. EOC does not send the notice, but let's search for blame of the claimant anyways. Maybe she was negligent in something. So in any other case, which would arise on the similar facts, even if there is no notice sent by EOC, defendant would be searching for kind of negligence or blame. And if anything comes up, they would say, oh, it wouldn't have mattered. But there is no bright line rule that it's not impossible to determine from which day it runs.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Pardis. And court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.